Welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and every Saturday from 3 to 5 here on the Republic Broadcasting Network, we do the Weekend Interview Show. I got Matt running all the electronics in the booth over there helping out, and on the phone is Alan Bach. He's the senior editorial writer at the Orange County Register and pens the weekly column Eye on the Empire for antiwar.com. He's the author of the books Ambush at Ruby Ridge and Waiting to Inhale, The Politics of Medical Marijuana. Welcome to the show, Alan Bach.
Thank you very much, Scott. Good to be here.
It's great to have you on. Everybody on my old radio show, I interviewed Alan a couple of times, and I'm a really big fan of your writing. I recommend especially to everybody to keep an eye on Eye on the Empire that Alan writes every week for antiwar.com. There's really some great stuff in there every week, and particularly the current Eye on the Empire column is titled No Semblance of Accountability, about the complete lack of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and the fact that apparently it doesn't matter. Is that right, Alan?
Well, I'm just fascinated by that. Now, I understand that there are, you know, strategic thinkers who will explain to you that, and in fact, Richard Pearl, the Prince of Darkness, at one time explained that, you know, we've settled on weapons of mass destruction for basically bureaucratic reasons.
Right. Because, oh, actually, I think, wasn't that Wolfowitz in the Vanity Fair article?
Was it Wolfowitz or Richard Pearl?
Either way.
It was, you know, they're sort of peas in a pod. You know, settled on it for bureaucratic purposes because it was easy to explain and we figured it would, you know, people would support it. But, the, you know, what's the main reason that we actually did invade Iraq? Was it actually to establish bases in a country with oil revenues and oil supplies?
Do you think that was the primary motivation, Alan?
You know, it's hard to tell when our leaders don't trust themselves to tell us what their real motives are. But that's certainly a lot more likely reason than to, you know, establish democracy. And, you know, somebody had to know somewhere along the way that the weapons of the information about the weapons of mass destruction was based on really, really shaky intelligence. On the Carnegie Endowment website, Joe Cirincione, more than a year ago, put up a piece about how the national intelligence estimate of October 2002 was radically out of line with all previous estimates about what kind of stuff Saddam Hussein had.
Is that because it was written by the guys in the Pentagon and not the CIA?
Well, I don't know. You know, it was basically doctored, you know, what you have to infer from it, because we don't have a whistleblower yet, is that they sort of, you know, got the wink and nod from the White House that, you know, we need some, you know, alarming stuff about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So they did this October 2002 assessment, and lo and behold, there was alarming stuff about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
You know, it's funny, the thing about the bureaucratic reasons, that's really not the name for it. It's really for propaganda reasons. They had to scare us into accepting that we needed to invade this country that everyone knew hadn't attacked us yet, right?
Well, absolutely, that's the case. Yeah, propaganda reasons is a much more, and I guess the worst part is
oh,
the
we'll
whole
be right
idea
back. Sorry, Alan. We'll be right back.
Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
right, everybody. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm talking with Alan Box. He's the, a senior columnist at the Orange County Register, or senior editorial writer at the Orange County Register, and he writes Eye on the Empire at antiwar.com. And, Alan, did you see Bush on Barbara Walters last night?
I watched a little bit of it, as much as I could stand.
Okay, well, I admit I didn't, but I read the transcript, and apparently he says he felt that they would find weapons of mass destruction.
I thought that was wonderful. I felt, so we're gonna commit Americans to be in harm's way and end up with at least 1,300 dead and 10,000 wounded in ways that are probably going to be more serious than has been the case with wounded people in previous wars, because our medicine has advanced to the case where we can save the lives of people who would have died otherwise, but they're going to spend the rest of their lives maimed or seriously handicapped. We're willing to do that because he had a feeling. You know, that's just outrageous that any leader could feel the least bit comfortable doing that on the basis of a feeling. I had a feeling.
And this goes right to the title and the topic of your recent column about accountability. These were the people, when the entire world was saying, well, we don't really know that they have any weapons of mass destruction. The UN was traipsing around wherever they wanted in Iraq saying, we can't find any weapons of mass destruction. If you have intelligence that says that you know where it is, well, tell us and we'll go and find it. And all they kept saying was, trust us. We know. We have the secret CIA powers, and we know the secret truth that you don't know. And so they had this whole war based on that, and now that all of that comes up bogus, Tenet, the head of the CIA, as you point out in your article, gets a medal. Rice gets promoted to Secretary of State. George Bush himself is reelected.
So we understand, you know, what pays in government. What pays in government is to lie and deceive and to put people in harm's way for no good reason. That's how you get promoted.
Yeah, the guy that wrote the torture memos just got made Attorney General.
Sort of gives you an idea of, you know, what it is that government is really all about. You know, it's not about protecting us or safeguarding us. It's about expanding the power of the state and expanding the power of the people who have control of the government, using the government for its own purposes, for the purposes of those who find it useful to use the political means of wealth acquisition rather than the economic means of wealth acquisition in order to enrich themselves and make themselves more powerful and wonderful.
I'm
that's
so glad to hear
about.
You say that, Alan.
I mean, that's it sort of gets to the root of what it's really there. You know, does anyone seriously believe anymore that the government is devoted to protecting us from great harms and evils in the world?
Actually, Joe Sobrin, I interviewed him a few weeks ago, and he said, it's not like these people come to town and say, you know, you people need services. Let us provide them for you. And, oh, well, you know, by the way, we're probably going to have to set up some sort of taxation system in order to pay for all this. No, they come wanting your money. And then they come up with the bribe later on as the after effect.
Mm-hmm. And then some people buy it, you know. Oh, gee whiz, it's so much more dangerous. It would be so much more dangerous if we didn't have Bush in the White House out there bombing people. You know, whereas years ago, way before 9/11, it was 97 or 98, the Army did various studies on where terrorist activities were putting Americans in danger, which parts of the world. It turns out, of course, you know, should this surprise anybody, that the parts of the world where the United States is most deeply involved, where we've got bases, where we've got troops, where we have puppet governments, are the places where terrorists are most active against American interests. You know, this should not surprise anyone, but this is something that's been documented by the U.S. government.
Well, just look at the hijackers.
If you really don't want to worry about be safe from terrorists, what we want to do is start to pull our forces out of countries where we have no business.
You look at the hijackers. They were all from countries that are friendly to us. They were not Iraqi and Iranian and North Korean. They were or Syrian. They were from Yemen and Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you make a lot of sense there, Mr. Bach, I must say. Well, you know what they say about the weapons of mass destruction now? I turned it to Fox News. I don't know what got into me. And they're saying, well, of course they can't find the weapons of mass destruction. That's because it's all in Syria. And so now we have to go and invade them.
You know, they've been... It's fascinating how many different stories they have come up with for the weapons of mass destruction and why they haven't been able to find them. And, you know, if we invade Syria, or even if Syria, maybe Syria will let the UN inspectors in. You know, that would be sort of interesting, wouldn't it?
No, well, they just do the same thing again, probably.
But, you know, wouldn't... And if when and when they're not found there, what would the, it's really fascinating that the people who were closest to the truth on this thing are the ones that you don't even hear on television anymore. You know, before the war, Scott Ritter, the former UN inspector and former Marine, was saying, you know, we destroyed those weapons. He doesn't have them. There's no evidence that he's reconstituted the programs yet. He turns out to be right, and do you hear him on any mainstream television or radio anymore?
Nope. So much for the Christian Science Monitor every once in a while, I think.
So the guys that are right about these things disappear, and the guys that are wrong continue to. I mean, we live in a culture in which accountability, the idea that you should be held responsible for what you do or say, and there should be a price for being wrong. It just is a totally foreign concept. I don't know how much longer a country that doesn't believe that people should be responsible for what they do and say, how much longer that can survive.
I was just thinking the same thing. I don't think it really can. You know, I was having a discussion with a friend of mine the other day about, well, you know how they ought to set up the election thing? Is there ought to be where any political party can get on the ballot. If you get 1 million signatures nationwide, you're guaranteed on the ballot for all 50 states, and then this and that, and it came down to the people in America don't want that. They don't care about that. There's nobody insisting that we have any more free and fair elections than there were in Russia. You know? I mean, we as long as there's two names on the ballot, whatever.
It's and I don't know. Is that because more people than before now understand that the elections are basically just a kind of a fraud? I don't know. To me, democracy is sort of our era's version of the divine right of kings. You know, it's the way that the government, the people who wield power over us, have chosen, you know, given historical circumstance and various other reasons, to justify the fact that they do wield power over us. You know, in the old days, you had theologians and various other apologists for power, you know, saying that kings ruled by divine right. It was God who decided, you know, he's going to be the king, and so you submit to him because you submit to God. Now it's you submit to him because the great God Demos, the great God of democracy, allows it to be. But, you know, it's just a farce. It's just a method of trying to validate and justify the people who want to rule over us anyway.
Indeed. Speaking of which, have you seen the BBC documentary, The Power of Nightmares?
I have not, although I just read an article that described it a little bit.
It's actually today's spotlight on your homepage there at antiwar.com today.
Oh.
And at the Information Clearinghouse, they have links to all 3 hours of it. It's actually quite long. But, Alan, in that movie, they basically make the case that, in fact, it's funny, it reminds me of a constitutionalist I heard comparing Al-Qaeda to a band of pirates and that they ought to be dealt with by mark and reprisal. Well, in this movie, The Power of Nightmares, they basically make Al-Qaeda out to be literally a band of pirates that you probably couldn't even fill a ship with. That Al-Qaeda, for intents and purposes, really doesn't even exist. I mean, when they say Al-Qaeda, what they really mean is Bin Laden, Zawahiri, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and maybe another couple of dozen guys. There is no Al-Qaeda at all. And this whole thing is completely a ploy, the same way Truman foisted the Cold War on us. And now we see the CIA reports coming out saying, oh, you know, in 20 years, Iraq is going to be producing so many terrorists against us. And it almost seems like they're doing all this failure on purpose, so they can guarantee themselves a war to have in the future?
Well, as Randolph Byrne said in World War I, war is the health of the state. War is how the state grows, how the state prospers, and how the state acquires more power. And the state, by its very nature, is always hungry for more power and for more resources and more revenue. So, of course, they want to keep wars going. And I guess the only question is just how utterly conscious of what they're doing are the people in power. I think some of them are completely aware that, you know, we got to keep wars going in order, and others are sort of duped by their own propaganda. You know, I think it's one of the reasons, for example, that the occupation of Iraq has gone so badly, and so that even a lot of people that were for the war are completely disillusioned by now. And I think part of it is because they believe their own propaganda. They really believed that, you know, the Iraqis were going to greet us with flowers and bread and sweetmeats and there would be no resistance to foreign occupation, which is completely opposite of historical experience anywhere.
Absolutely right. All right, we'll be right back, everybody, with Alan Bott from the Orange County Register. Stay right there. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott, and the guest is Alan Bott. He's a senior editorial writer at the Orange County Register. He also writes Eye on the Empire for antiwar.com. And, you know, you were talking about these people kind of believing their own public relations, and seems sort of, really, with few exceptions, a widespread accepted belief around the world that there must be central authority in everyone's life. And it's funny to read, for example, the BBC on their website. They have some interesting articles about Somalia, and just aghast, just absolutely shocked. Did you know that there hasn't been a central government in Somalia for 10 years now? And it's, oh my goodness gracious, they can't believe it. And in fact, now they're going to send in AU troops, African Union troops, to come and install a government that's been waiting in exile in Somalia, because it must be the solution to whatever's wrong in that land. And I know that you've taken an interest to some degree in this subject, Mr. Box. So I wonder what are your thoughts about that?
Well, there was a real good piece about a year ago in Liberty magazine by a Dutchman who married a Somali woman. And talked about, you know, how things went with and without a centralized nation state, and pointed out that, when the UN pulled out of Somalia back in, what was it, 94 or so, for a while it was a little bit chaotic, but what happened was that the traditional tribal leadership reasserted itself, and so you had localized, control of various things. You had a traditional system of justice based on the traditional Somali religion and the traditional Somali tribal ideas. And after a couple of years, for example, in the major port city, trade increased, prosperity increased. So the idea that every country has to have a nation state on a Western European model is one of the, what would you say? One of the myths of modern times. It's really a superstition, I guess. That's what I would call it. Without a strong centralized government, there's going to be chaos and disorder, when in fact, if you really analyze things, it's more often the case that a strong centralized government creates chaos and disorder rather than preventing chaos and disorder.
Sure, but it's just like the whole power of nightmares thing implies, that you got to have something to believe in, and why not the state, you know, as long as it's something. And that really is the crisis, right, that through the 20th century, the politicians had this whole better future where everything's going to be great, And since they couldn't deliver that, they had to deliver something, so they deliver fear instead, because they need some excuse.
Well, Machiavelli, you know, explained that fear, you know, for the leader, for the prince, fear is much more effective than love. You know, it'd be nice if the people love you, but the people will obey you if they fear you.
Well, I have this article from yesterday.
And he also, you know, that he had great insights. You know, if you've got trouble at home, create a war. You know, if you have domestic problems, if you're starting to face a little bit of dissent at home, create a war, because that will rally the people around you and give you reason to suppress dissent and say, you know, well, it's all in the interest of our country, of patriotism.
Well, and there sure is plenty of precedent for that kind of thing in American history, too, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
Back on Somalia here for a second, Alan. I have this article from yesterday on 1/14/2005 from the BBC News by a guy named Joseph Winter about telecoms thriving in lawless Somalia and how the place really is kind of divided up into warlords, and it's not all that easy necessarily getting from one part of town to the other without having to pay a tribute. And it's basically run by, according to the BBC, different mafias and that kind of thing. But the telecom industry, nobody messes with them because nobody wants the phones to go out. And that in Somalia, the cell phone and internet industries are taking off better, and the prices are lower than anywhere in Africa. That you can get a landline installed in Somalia in less than a week, whereas in neighboring Kenya next door, it can sometimes take up to a year.
Gosh, could that be because the industry is more heavily regulated because of Kenya having a stronger centralized state, and so therefore the government people have to get their little slice before anyone else gets their slice, and oh, they have to guarantee safety too, don't they?
Yeah.
And all these things create bureaucracies and create delays.
Now, to be fair, and this is still the BBC, so I don't know. I've never been to Africa, but. They do describe, they have quite a few stories on their website, and describe a pretty hard life for a lot of people in Somalia, and they're basically run by different mafia syndicates in competition and to some degree cooperation, runs the place. But it seems the ingrained belief in all the people interviewed by the BBC that once we get one big mob to stop all the smaller private mobs, then everything's going to be fine.
Well, maybe it would be easier to deal with just one big mob, I suppose.
Yeah, maybe. All right, it's the weekend interview show.
The payoff will be larger. You can trust me on that.
Yeah. All right, we'll be right back with Alan Bock from the Orange County Register. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the weekend interview show. I'm Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com if you want to listen to any of the archives. Or if you're just tuning in and you want to hear the first half of the Alan Bock interview, you'll have to go there too, weekendinterviewshow.com. And Alan Bock is a senior editorial writer at the Orange County Register and writes Eye on the Empire for antiwar.com. Now, Alan, maybe an underdeveloped East African nation like Somalia isn't the perfect testing ground for Rothbardian anarchy, but you know, I was thinking there's one place on earth that could really use respect for individualism and property rights, and that's Israel. And I noticed that before Prime Minister.
True.
Oh, go ahead.
And it's a place where to a great extent there's a kind of a natural inclination toward respect for property rights and individualism in Israel, although there are certainly plenty of factions within Israel that are, what would you say, more group oriented and less individualist oriented. But Israelis by and large, and I spent a week there last year, strike me as very self-reliant types of people. They kind of have to be.
Hey, thou shalt not steal, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty basic.
Yeah, it seems like it. Although the problem is that if you're a Palestinian, apparently, to the Israeli government anyway, you're not an individual. You're part of them, the Palestinians. And so, for example, they can take part of your land and then give some different land somewhere else to the Palestinians, and that balances out, even though you just got half of your land taken as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's no way to have peace, I don't think.
You know, it's always the case that, you know, what the job of a government is to divide people into us and them. You know, that's one of the first things any government does is to define a them that turns out to be the enemy, because if there's not a them, then why the heck do you need the government to protect you?
Aha. Uh-huh. Hey, you're not supposed to ask that question. Don't get too far now here. Well, and, you know, Alan, really, I rely on you to give me the positive spin and the silver lining. You know, that's what I love about your column so much, is that when I read, you know, the top 200 headlines on the front page of antiwar.com, and I'm terribly depressed, then I click on the Alan Bot column, and there's always some kind of silver lining or faint hope for something in there somewhere, right?
Yeah, but the hope is pretty faint. You know, we're talking about Israel, and they just had the election of Abu Mazen or Mahmoud Abbas as president of the Palestinian Authority, and it's up to that time, you know, there were all these people saying, you know, is Yasser Arafat dead, and you know, a new person coming to power, and you know, he may not really be a moderate, but he'll have to act like a moderate, and you know, the prospects for peace are just so great. And I guess I tried in that column to sort of look at the underlying reality and say, you know, don't get your hopes up that greatly. And naturally, just yesterday, there was an article that said that, well, Israel has cut off all communication with Mahmoud Abbas, the new president of the Palestinian Authority. And so all these people are going to say, you know, let's pull out the roadmap and peace is just around the corner. I'm all for silver linings, but you need to be realistic in that situation.
Yeah, well, the guy hadn't even been sworn in yet and already cut off communication with him. He's in the West Bank, and they're going, oh, if you can't control every Hamas militant in the Gaza Strip, well, you don't deserve to be negotiated with by us.
Well,
it's sort of like, you know, Alan Bot commits a crime, and the world holds George Bush responsible for not being able to control your day-to-day behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, George Bush better do something about that Alan Bach, or we're going to do it for him.
The problem is, on both sides of that conflict, you don't have sufficient war weariness yet. There are still people on both sides who believe that they're going to be able to get what they want through violence and slaughter. There are still Palestinians who think that if they just keep up this terrorism long enough, eventually the Israelis will lose heart and they'll be able to shove them into the sea, or at least, you know, send them back to, you know, whatever part of Europe or, you know, they originally migrated from. And there are still Israelis who think that, you know, all we need to do is just, you know, show them that we're tough and firm enough, and they'll give up this violence. They're both wrong. You know, the way to at least reduce violence is to stop using violence. You know, it's a sort of a simple cause and effect situation, don't you think?
Sure, I can apply one of my Alan Bach maxims here, and that is, it's not just that the ends don't justify the means, but the means often determine what the end is going to be.
Sure, and so if you're using violent and destructive means, you're going to have violent and destructive ends. That's what you're going to end up with.
You know, Alan. Oh,
so
I'm
it
sorry.
Seems to me that there's two things. Eventually, war weariness will set in on both sides because nobody except a completely insane person can stand living in that kind of chaos for very long. The other thing is, I think that will happen faster if we start to think of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as one of many local conflicts that will have to be resolved locally. You know, during the Cold War, everybody thought that, you know, it was just another venue for U.S.-Soviet conflict to play itself out. Since the end of the Cold War, I don't see any reason for the U.S. to be involved in it. And I think it will be resolved faster if the U.S. says, okay, you know, this is your guys' squabble here, and someday you guys are going to come to a resolution of it. And if there's some constructive role we can play when you really, really are ready to get together, you know, then, okay, we'll provide you some meeting places, and maybe we'll even send a little aid your way. But what everybody, you know, that from Bush on down, although Bush may be slightly more realistic on this, which is hard to believe that he would be realistic on anything, but there's so many people that think that if you just force it a little bit, if you just, you know, pressure Israel and pressure the Palestinian leadership to sort of get together and talk, maybe this time, you need to wait until the underlying conditions are ripe for it. You can't force it from the outside. That's the root of wisdom there.
Which brings up the question to me whether your wisdom on that issue and libertarian, non-interventionist foreign policy thought in general, is it ever really going to be part of the debate in this country? I mean, when I read Foreign Affairs, I don't read articles by Alan Bach in there.
Well, we'll see if we can get a few in the near future. I guess that's sort of the next book I'm going to work on, and I've just started an outline of it. But, you know, the working title in my mind is Beyond Empire. And I think the case is, you know, we've tried empire, and it hasn't worked out that well. I mean, just looking at Iraq, we got 150,000 troops there, and military people like to have a rotation such that would require, in essence, about 450,000 troops in order to maintain 150,000 troops there on a permanent basis. Meaning, when you've got your 150,000, you've got another 150,000 in training to go there. And another group that has just returned from there, and they're doing a little R&R, debriefing. In preparation for training to go back there. And if you're going to have, you're going to cycle people in and out of there, you basically need three times the number that you're going to have there. Our entire army is just a little over 500,000. We've got about 175,000 Marines and some Air Force and other people. So either we're going to have to, if we want to maintain that kind of an occupation, either we're going to have to go to a draft or we're going to have to start paying volunteers an awful lot more because we're already starting to see morale problems. I think eventually reality comes back and bites us, and people begin to think, okay, I mean, do we really need to occupy Iraq? We've already got a situation where, you know, 56 to 60% of the American people think the Iraq war was not worth fighting. That doesn't mean they want to pull out tomorrow because so many people sort of buy into Colin Powell's you break it, you bought it, and you've got to do something about it before you turn it over to the Iraqis. But I think Americans are going to get increasingly impatient about that. You know, why is it our business to run every country in the world?
And, you know, there's a big flaw with that pottery barn analogy, which is it is human beings. It's not you break it, you bought it. They're human beings, and you break their country. If they want you to buy it and stay there and put it back together, fine. But, you know, it's possible for someone to break something in a pottery shop and the owner to say, just get out. I'll clean it up, you know. I don't need any more of your help here.
You know, that's a very good point, Scott. You know, I have little doubt that there are a lot of Iraqis that are happy to see the Americans there, and I'm sure that a good deal of what the American troops are doing there is constructive. But it doesn't take a very large percentage of people to engage in acts of insurgency to really screw things up badly. And, you know, even if you took a poll and said, you know, 80% of Iraqis are happy that the Americans are there and want them to stay, if even a small portion of that 20% are taking up arms, it's gonna be untenable. It's not gonna be something that you can sustain unless you want to do something really brutal, unless you really want to just, you know, slaughter people wholesale.
And that still might not even work.
And that still might not work. But, you know, and the other thing that makes me sort of optimistic in the long run is Americans don't have that imperial mentality. During the time of the British Empire, partly because Britain was a small little country that had limited resources and limited opportunities, it was not at all unusual for people of, you know, of ambition to want to say, you know, my best bet is to go overseas, stay overseas for long periods of time, make my fortune there, and then maybe retire to old Blighty, with enough money to buy a country estate and you know, live a life of ease in my dotage. Americans don't have that idea that they're going to come overseas. As soon as somebody goes overseas, we tie yellow ribbons everywhere. And when American soldiers and sailors and Marines go overseas, the first thing they think about is how soon am I going to be able to come back home? You know, we've got an attractive country that people love to be in. You know, why should we want to have an overseas empire? So we don't have that attitude that I think is necessary to sustain an imperial endeavor. We don't have that attitude that, you know, the way to get ahead in America is to go overseas and help run the empire for a while. People that go into the military, yeah, of course, they've made a conscious decision that they're going to spend some time where they may be in harm's way. But the idea of spending years and years and years in imperial safeguarding overseas, no. There's hardly any Americans that have that attitude. So we're not going to be able to sustain this empire. We need to move beyond empire. And the way to move beyond empire is to find a new and sort of restore the whole idea that our job, as John Quincy Adams said in the 1900s, is to be the friend of freedom everywhere, but the guarantor only of our own.
And I
think in time Americans are going to be ready for that, despite what so many of our leaders think is necessary.
Well, I totally agree with you. I guess there are some people who are just really on the bandwagon at this point or whatever, but it's primarily only those in the highest levels of the state who really have these grandiose dreams. And like you say, it's really not just outside of the American character, but it's really in direct contradiction to, I think, you know, everything from Thomas Jefferson to Luke Skywalker and all of our history is rebellion against empire, that this is the land of individualism and liberty. And we were founded by telling an empire to get their army the heck off of our continent, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I really hope you're right about that. I think you're right that it's going to be too hard to convince us to keep this going. Unless, of course, some more stuff blows up, Alan, because some more stuff blows up and then they can do whatever they want with us for another few years and then we'll get tired of it again and then something else will blow up again, right? Sorry, man.
I sort of hate to acknowledge that, you know, that if there's another attack that essentially our leaders are going to be able to have their way is for several years, that there won't be more skepticism. But you may be right. You may be right. You know, I have the hope that it will happen sooner, that people will start to say, well, wait just a minute. Something blew up, and it's because you guys failed at what you're supposed to do. Why should we give you more power, more authority, and more control over our daily lives when you've just demonstrated that you can't handle that power and authority, that you can't do what you're supposed to do?
Absolutely.
Maybe what we need is for the government to have less power and less authority over our lives.
Imagine what private security and private ownership of firearms could have done on September 11th had not the government been intervening in those matters. I mean, little old lady on flight 175 just stands up and shoots some hijackers in the face, and that's the end of that. And the big news story is there was some attempted hijackings today, but the American citizens shot the hijackers dead before any harm was done.
That's the way it would have worked. My idea on airplanes is they should inspect you for firearms, and if you didn't bring your own, issue you one.
Yeah, there you go. All right, everybody, hang tight. We'll be right back to wrap up with Alan Bach from the Orange County Register. It's the Weekend Interview Show. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show, wrapping up our interview of Alan Bach. He is a senior editorial writer at the Orange County Register, and he writes an excellent column at antiwar.com called Eye on the Empire. And you're the best, Alan. This has been a pretty fun ride. I'm glad you came along.
Well, let me just push one more thing. People haven't been buying my book, Waiting to Inhale, on Amazon.com too much lately, but... The Supreme Court is about to come down with another medical marijuana decision, which is very interesting, because the medical marijuana advocates are basically arguing a federalist program.
Isn't it great? I have a whole section set up to talk about this in the next hour. The new blue federalists.
Well, what they're arguing is essentially that what's happening with these patients in California is that they've got a cooperative situation going where friends grow marijuana for patients, and no money changes hands, and because no money changes hands, there's no commerce, so there's not even a remote implication about interstate commerce, so therefore the federal government has no justification to be involved in that at all.
Well, but I thought you can't even grow wheat to feed your family without being regulated.
Well, apparently you can't. But what's fascinating is that the Rehnquist Supreme Court has been trying to restore a semblance of federalism in certain areas. So it'll be interesting to see when it's marijuana whether they're going to be consistent with the kind of position that they've had before. Which they've argued in the Lopez case and various other cases that the Commerce Clause does not give the government unlimited power to regulate everything that moves, breathes, thinks, or stands still. So we'll see if how consistent the conservatives on the Supreme Court are in this issue. And if you want all the background, go buy Waiting to Inhale, The Politics of Medical Marijuana, and it's available on Amazon.com or at your local Barnes & Noble or Borders.
There you go. Here goes one more plug. Alan, as author of Waiting to Inhale, The Politics of Medical Marijuana, I need your advice. A friend of mine is part of the Libertarian Party here in Texas, and he's helping out with Texans for Medical Marijuana, who are planning on going and lobbying the state legislature this year. And I was telling him, you know, you're in kind of a tight jam because it's pretty hard to make federalist arguments to liberal Democrat types, and I don't think there's the slightest chance of the Republican majority in Texas wanting to do anything contrary to George Bush, their leader, in the White House. And so I wonder, do you have any advice for lobbyists going down there trying to pester these Texas legislators into doing something right?
It'll be hard as long as GW is in the White House.
Even though he's from Connecticut, he's not even from here.
Well, this is true. But
sorry, I have to say that at every opportunity.
But some, you know, he managed to cultivate at least a part of an accent for a while, didn't he?
Yeah, he's got a little linguist following him around all the time, reminding him to say y'all.
I would say get in touch with the people in Montana. Noticed in Montana this last time, they had a big majority for George W. Bush. It's a quintessential red state, and they passed a medical marijuana initiative. So a lot of the people that are for George W. Bush and a lot of the people that are Christian conservatives understand that medical marijuana is a different kind of an issue. Because here's a place where you can really be a compassionate conservative. Here's a place where you can say the rights of a person who is ill, who is facing, in some cases facing imminent death, you know, ought to stand, ought to prevail over the whim of some bureaucrat in Washington, or over the whim of a weaselly politician who's too afraid to raise this issue because he's